Just not too long ago, on April 4th, the New York Times ran an opinion piece which was entitled Bye Bye Baby. And the piece started by saying nearly half of all people now live in countries where women, on average, give birth to fewer than 2.1 babies, the number generally required to replace both parents over their lifetimes. This is true in Melbourne and Moscow, Sao Paulo and Seoul, Tehran and Tokyo. It's not limited to the West or to rich countries. It's happening all over the world. It then went on to say that this is news to many people, and it's also a source of alarm, even hysteria, mostly in the West. Stephen Philip Kramer, a professor at National Defense University, says rich countries with low fertility should adopt pronatalist policies to close the baby gap and arrest the spiral of even fewer workers supporting even more retirees. And the article continues that even the usually sober economist recently warned about the vanishing Japanese. So we've been getting some press on these issues, and Stephen, who's written this book, is joining us here today to talk about his book and some of his thoughts. Stephen, welcome.
We have a fairly unique moment in the history of the world, because there's never been a time when, you know, people have voluntarily produced fewer children than is necessary for, you know, sustaining the population. And that's the thing which has made the last 100 years really different. And that means I'd like to go back to this key concept of the demographic transition. The reason is that we've heard a great deal for a long time about overpopulation. I don't mean Thomas Malthus, but, you know, in the last 50 years, overpopulation has been seen as a huge thing. So the idea of having a book or books that talks about the declining birth rate seems, in a way, absurd. If you see these as two completely independent trends having nothing to do with each other, then people say, well, why do you want to deal with declining populations? We have too many people in other parts of the world. Well, the thing is that there is the concept of the demographic transition that helps to explain the relationship between these two things. That they're not two separate things. They're part of one big trend. I think that's the key point. And what happened was that the world always had high birth rates and high mortality. People had a lot of babies, and most of them died. And somehow or other, more or less, we managed to sustain a population that didn't grow very much for a very, very long period of time. And that was the history until the 19th century. In the 19th century, something changes. Demographers aren't 100% sure, but probably public health, improved nutrition, and then eventually modern medicine, and mortality rates decline in Europe, beginning in the 19th and even more at the end of the 19th century. And then suddenly a lot of children live longer and you have a real growth in the population. Europe goes from being maybe 5% of the population of the world to 25% of the population of the world. Then eventually people take into account the fact that, you know, they don't need that many children, that more children are surviving, and they begin to have fewer, and they begin to use the techniques of contraception. And so that happens in the late 19th, early 20th century. In the meantime, many of these people were absorbed into the Industrial Revolution, or they come here, or they go to South America, or they go to the colonies. The same thing happens in Asia. After World War II, the birth rate in Japan was 5 or 6 children. This falls precipitously. And, of course, what happens, though, as populations decline in Europe and in Asia, is they don't stop at the magical number of 2.1, which is what guarantees, you know, a sustainable population. Now, and that's sort of the problem, that deep down we all think the universe makes sense. You know, there are laws of, you know, Adam Smith creates laws of the economic universe, and that there's somehow or other when the birth rate will decline and go to a sustainable level, but it doesn't, it just keeps going down, in many cases, to a very, very low level. That's the problem which presents itself in Europe in the 1930s. And that's when the issue of do you do something about low birth rates becomes a real issue at the time.
But isn't population and world population still increasing? And if so, so why is it important to talk about the dangers of declining birth rates? You talk about this moment in time.
Well, because, you know, we don't have a completely global society. The world is not like the United States is. If you have too many people in one state and not enough jobs, people move around. But the world is still composed of states and nation states. And you can't just have vast numbers of people move easily from one place to the other. Well, I mean, immigration is an important thing. Most of the time, much of the time, it's a very useful thing. But if that immigration is on too large a scale, it's hard to absorb people in society. And the political consequences of immigration are really huge, especially, for example, at the time of the Great Recession. Look at how Europeans are reacting to what, in fact, is very little immigration. They're reacting by voting for the extreme right. When the European elections take place next month, it's going to be pretty awful. So there are limits to how you can solve the problem of immigration. Meanwhile, societies, advanced societies, may find they really have too few people. And that's why it makes sense to try to think about how you can have a modest improvement in birth rates in advanced societies. Japan would be an extreme case because there the population is going to go down very quickly because they don't allow any immigration.
Could you talk a little bit more about the influence of the Catholic Church in Italy?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's interesting because the influence of the Church is not what you might think. Because in terms of affecting people's sexual life, that influence is almost negligible. People don't follow the Church's dictates. They use contraception one fashion or other. They have very, very few children. So it's clear that the message of the Church isn't being followed, with one exception that in Italy, children are almost entirely within wedlock, which is very different from France or Sweden. We could talk about that mm-hmm. later. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, the Church's influence politically is very strong. Some people have even argued that its influence is greater now than it was in the old days. You know, in the old days in Italy, in the previous republic, the days when Christian democracy was the dominant party and the Communist Party was the main opposition, Christian Democrats had huge power. They held the government most of the time. So you might think with the end of that, the Church's role would have declined, but not really, because now there are people on the left who also come out of a kind of Catholic political culture. And so they have support on both sides of the aisles. In a system which is really dysfunctional most of the time, when it's hard to pass legislation, the Church adds a big dimension in opposing any kind of programs that make it easier for women to work and have children, especially things like daycare, preschool kind of thing. In that way, they hope that they will maintain the traditional family. Well, the result is that it's much harder for women to work and have children, with the result that although the traditional family survives, the birth rate is really, really low. And there's the paradox. You know, conservatives have always wanted to defend the traditional family. But where you have a traditional family relatively intact, the father working, the mother at home, the birth rates are lower than in countries like Northern Europe, where women work and also have more children than in Italy. So, you know, one of the things that's wonderful about this research is, you know, if you go in, you know, as an outsider, you learn a lot. There are a lot of paradoxes about this. And that's what makes it such a fascinating subject to study.
So let's talk about France and Sweden.
Okay.
Why did they become involved in developing a pro-natalist government policy?
Okay. Well, I'll start with Sweden. In Sweden, by the 1930s, the birth rate was the lowest in Europe. It was about 1.7 children below the level of sustainability. The debate at that time was the usual debate where, you know, people who were on the left had basically said it's not a big problem, and people on the right said, aha, what's the problem? It's the new woman, as it were. It's those women who are non-traditionally going to work, you know, contraception, all those terrible things, threat to the traditional family. So the debate was not a very, very wonderful debate, not a very rich debate. When the Great Depression hit Europe, the Swedish Social Democrats came to power. I think that there are a few parties in modern history that have shown the real political genius of the Social Democrats. I mean, they had seen, you know, democratic states in Europe overrun by fascism. They saw the collapse of Germany, the SPD's deplorable performance, Austrian socialists unable to resist the fascism. And they realized that the same thing could happen in Sweden. So they came up with a set of new ideas, which ideas that would later be called Keynesian, but they were developed by their own people. And so they turned around the economic crisis. As I point out in my book, one of the people who was a relatively young intellectual who came up with some new theories about economics was Gunnar Myrdal. And he and his wife were very interested in population issues. In 1935, they wrote a book together on the population crisis. And they managed to convince the Social Democrats that this was an issue that had a vital impact on the future of Sweden. The Prime Minister, Hansen, said population is the most important problem facing the country today, in 1935. And so Myrdal sees economic development and population as part of a whole. And that, I think, is one reason that he manages to convince the government that something needs to be done. And so they pass some legislation, for example, maternity leave, the right to return to a job for women after they're pregnant, that kind of stuff. They have a lot of other ideas. It's not till later that those ideas are developed. But the basic concepts that underlie all modern thinking on this are developed by Myrdal. And here's what they are. One, that society has to make it possible for women to reconcile work and family. If you can't do that, women are not going to have children. Two, children are very expensive, and they make families poor. And therefore, if you want to have children in a society, the government, the state, has to develop a kind of horizontal redistribution where people with fewer children help provide the funds for people with more. The government has to provide funding for families with children. And you have to have housing and education that's appropriate so these children develop well. And you have to have programs which are not monetary programs, not giving people money, but social programs like preschool, which take care of children and help them assimilate into the society and develop educationally. And so the Myrdal has come up with these ideas, and they're all at the basis of probably modern thinking. The war takes place, the baby boom takes place, and you don't really have to worry about population for a while, and then birth rates fall again. And then these ideas become the basis for the Swedish system, which is a logical system that basically takes care of the insecurity which surrounds most women and most families with having children, which I think many people in this room have experienced firsthand. I know I certainly did as a father. You know, a year maternity leave paid, you know, almost fully salary, a right to return to a job within 2.5 years, an excellent system of public preschool, and they stress the word as preschool rather than daycare because it's meant to be educational, and a system whereby, you know, it's very easy for men as well as women to take time off if their children are sick. And this creates a much less stressful experience in being a parent. And that sort of keeps the birth rate up. No, it's not huge. It's a birth rate that, you know, fluctuates to a bad sustainable to 1.7. But compared to much of the rest of Europe, it's fabulous. And so I think the main point here is the economic crisis was linked somehow in people's minds to the problem of birth rates. And that's what did it in Sweden. Now, France is completely different because France became involved in this because of national security in the most direct way. I mean, France had a very different experience from any other country in Europe because, you know, in Europe, as I said, when the demographical transition took place, most countries' birth rates remain the same, death rates rise, a huge demographic dividend, a lot of kids. In France, as the birth rate, as the death rate declines, the birth rate declines almost perfectly in tandem, with the result that the French population barely increases in the first half of the 19th century, and often deaths are greater than births in the second half of the 19th century. Well, from the point of view of some economists at the time, that's fine. It kept wages up and so on. The real reason people were doing it, I think, was largely that most people lived on the land. The revolution had divided property into small plots, and you couldn't support a lot of people. You could only have one son to really take over the land. That may be the most important thing. Then comes 1870, the Franco-Prussian War. There's horrible defeat that frankly, nobody in France was prepared for. And people were, at the time, said, among the many reasons they advanced for the defeat was, you know, we once had a lot more people than anybody else, and now there are as many Germans as there are French. And the way things are going, there'll be a lot more Germans than there are French. In fact, in World War I, there were 50% more Germans than there were French. So it becomes a matter of national security. Something has to be done. And so you have a pro-natalist movement. But the movement didn't exactly have a great public relations approach because, you can't say, tell women that they should have more children so that you can send them to the trenches so they can die fighting the Germans. That's really going to get women to have a lot of children. You were living in a world of low-tax government, and so there was no financial benefits that were offered. And people went around saying, well, you should tell people if they don't have children, then they can't vote. If you don't have three children, you shouldn't be able to vote or hold office or have a public job, all of which was total nonsense because, you know, if most people had few children, they weren't going to vote for members of parliament who were going to cut their raise their taxes or cut their salaries. It was nonsense. It wasn't until 1939, 2 months before the war started, that the government of the Third Republic under Daladier issues the Code de la Famille. And that is a transforming moment. They basically say, we will pay people more if they have children. People's salaries wages will be increased based on the number of children they have. You'll get a tangible benefit to be able to afford having more children. And this was done, so July 29th, 1939, the end of the Republic. A few months later, a year later, Vichy. And Vichy, for his own crazy reasons, supports this legislation for different reasons. And then de Gaulle and the resistance come to power, and they preserve it, but they go a step further, which is, I think, the essence of what French policy became. After World War II, during the resistance, there was a genuine attempt to understand what went wrong. And they linked together the stalemate society, as it was called, the lack of economic growth, the lack of economic dynamism, the fact it was run by old people, the fact that France had fallen behind Germany in industrialization, and they linked it to Malthusianism, not enough children. And therefore, they said, we have to break from this mold. And that leads to the Monnet Plan. You know, the French government will plan economic growth, and it leads to demographic planning as well. The measures that are necessary to create population growth are instituted in France. Under very, very well-known people, it becomes a real focus for government, and a lot of money will be spent in France to make it possible for women to have children and for families to be able to afford children. And in the first round, it's the traditional family, more money for the father who's working, the mother at home. That becomes indefensible by the 1960s when women are working. And under the Gaullists, it's turned around so that working women actually get more of the benefits. And so France develops this robust system of support for families, which, and about 4% of the gross national product is spent for families in both France and Sweden. And these policies are extremely successful, and they become iconic. Nobody in France really, you know, wants to touch them. So that's how those two countries managed to come up with models. Well, these models are not unique. I mean, Scandinavia more or less has a motto. Most countries are sort of like the Swedish. The French are sort of unique. In Southern Europe, more or less follows, is like Italy, very big problems with birth rates. Spain, you know, Italy, Greece, all the southern countries have very low birth rates. And the great exception, the really puzzling case, is that Germany has one of the lowest birth rates in Europe. And that's another issue that we could talk about later if you want. So thank you, yeah.